Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Everybody, I'm Kim Holderness.
And I'm Penn Holderness, and you have stumbled upon the Holderness Family Podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
We are so excited to bring you our interview with Michael Easter. If you are a listener to this podcast, you've heard us name drop him a lot, and that we were both obsessed with his book, The Comfort Crisis. He has a new book out, and we're going to talk all about that. But first, we have to do the business
housekeeping
part.
If you will.
Yeah. We are trying something new. I mean, today could be a start of a book club, if you will.
Sure.
But we are going to have a book club episode in 2 weeks on November 7th with Nikki Ehrlich. She's the author of The Measure, and she's going to join us to discuss that book. I've read it. Penn has not.
So here's the thing. Bear with me. It's not that I'm being lazy, because I'm actually interested in this book, but I think I'm going to not read it so that I can represent the person who's in the corner of book club who's just showing up for the wine and just kind of BS's her way through the entire evening, because there is one of those in every book club, right?
Most, I remember showing up to my first book club meeting and I was the only one who had read the book.
Did they admit it, or were they like...
Oh, nobody was like, oh, I didn't know we were actually doing that. So anyway, if you have questions for Nikki or discussion prompts for a book episode, or even have suggestions about our next book, go email them to podcast@theholdernessfamily.com, and we will also link that email in the show notes.
So let's talk about Michael Easter. Great guy. We're about to bring him on, but I think before we do, Kim and I want to give you guys just a sort of a gist, not quite a full synopsis, but a gist of not only the book that he has just put out called Scarcity Brain, but also the first book that led to us trying to learn how to kite surf, which is called The Comfort Crisis.
Michael Easter is a best-selling author of the books The Comfort Crisis and his new book, Scarcity Brain, Fix Your Craving Mindset and Rewire Your Habits to Thrive with Enough. Easter has dedicated his life to researching and writing about what leads humans to live healthier, happier, and remarkable lives. In his book, The Comfort Crisis, because we are going to be referencing this later on in the podcast, so I just want to explain what it's about if you haven't read it. It sort of explains that embracing discomfort and reframing your mindset and kind of rewiring your bad habits leads to some pretty cool stuff. And those thoughts have been implemented by professional sports teams, elite military units, Fortune 500 companies. And they've changed how top institutions view topics ranging from physical and mental health to improving performance in business, sports, and even warfare. We are going to get into The Comfort Crisis more at the end of this podcast, but we do mention the term misogy.
Yes.
Again, if you've listened to this podcast, we've talked about it. But if you haven't, just to explain, because we kind of jump into it, the rules of misogy. Number one, the rule is to make it really hard. Number two, don't die. So it's something...
It's a yearly trek that he does, right?
Yeah, so it's
once a year.
Once a year, it's something that you are encouraged to pick something that's pretty out of your comfort zone, not just physically, but mentally. So if you run 20 miles on a weekend, running a marathon's not a misogy. If you run a 10K and you try to run a marathon, yeah, there's a good misogy. Penn and I chose this year to try to learn how to kite surf. We ate a lot of water. It was really hard. Yeah. I don't know if we could call it a success, but it was both mentally and physically challenging. So we're like checking the box on that.
And his thing was, it's a good idea to look for something that has a 50-50 chance of success.
Right.
if you can find something.
So
like that.
You're primed there for the discussion at the end of the podcast.
Right. So let's talk about Scarcity Brain, which is his newer book, where he really starts by just asking a bunch of questions. This is how Michael works. And he goes into all of these places to ask these questions. And so he wanted to know why scrolling on your phone for just 5 minutes turned into countless hours. He wanted to know why you might eat simply because you're bored. And also, like, with social media and TikTok, why it's easier than ever to become almost like a squirrel saving for winter, like wanting more and more and more. So Michael Easter wrote Scarcity Brain. And his thesis is the problem is a scarcity mindset. And that mindset was left over from like ancient ancestors. And he does this a lot in his book. He takes us back to sort of, I guess, cavemen almost in the way that our brain works, because they had to constantly seek and consume to survive, because vital survival tools like food and material goods and information and even power were scarce and they were really hard to find. But so fast forward to now, we can easily fulfill all of those ancient desires for more. And because of that, that hardwired scarcity brain that we've had since we were cavemen is now backfiring. And it's leading to these repeat behaviors that are fun in the short term, but they hurt us in the long run. So we're going to talk to him about identifying those things and really you and I, what we personally are dealing with and what resonates with us, because he talks about a lot of stuff. And then he's going to talk to us about how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm psyched to be here.
Hey, we're really thrilled to have you. We're obviously, as we said before, we love your books. I want to know, like, you have taken us on all of these journeys to self-discovery and self-improvement that make us all want to be better people. But I would love to go back, you know, 10 years, however long it takes to meet the Michael Easter before he started this journey.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot. Well, I mean, I grew up in Utah and left when I was 18. So I went to college on the East Coast and then ended up working in magazines, which, you know, I had always been a book and magazine junkie, but didn't think that that was a way that you could make a living. Mm-hmm. But I took a writing class in college and it was just like, this is what I want to do with my life. So I worked in magazines, and eventually once you get to a certain place in magazines, you stop writing as much. They start having you edit. They start, you know, asking you questions like, would you please figure out how to save journalism, print journalism in the moment? And that was not what I wanted to do. So I ended up taking a job as a professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And the upside of that is that half my job is the teaching, but the other half is continuing to write. And yeah, once I started doing that, I don't know, I had just written enough articles and felt like there was a book idea there with the comfort crisis. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I went for it and it worked out. I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah,
mostly I would love to know, just, you touched on it a bit in the comfort crisis, but you definitely had different habits and a different sort of lifestyle as well, and an outlook on life, didn't you?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. So in the comfort crisis, I write about how I got sober about 9 years ago. And that was really the, I think, impetus that made me realize, you know, if you want to improve your life, you often have to do things that are challenging and uncomfortable. But by going through short-term discomfort, your life often improves afterwards. And that was 100% the story of getting sober. I mean, that's the hardest thing I've ever done by far. Mm-hmm. And so that realization, paired with the fact that I was working at Men's Health magazine, which literally everything that magazine covers, if you want to get the sort of the benefit at the end, you're going to have to go through short-term discomfort, whether it's, you know, exercise and improving your health, whether it's losing weight, you're probably going to have to be hungry at some point, even improving your mental health. You have to have tough conversations with yourself and others. And so to me, really the sort of story of improvement in modern life is being willing to sort of embrace short-term discomfort and do things that maybe aren't fun in the short term, but you get a long-term benefit.
Your new book, we're talking about the scarcity brain. Could you explain, just set it up for folks that haven't had the chance to read it, what is the scarcity loop and why we need to be aware of it?
Yeah. So I probably the easiest way to explain it is that it's the sort of serial killer of moderation. So it's this three-part behavior loop that I discovered by going into this casino in Las Vegas that is used entirely for human research, like human behavior research. And yeah, it's something that leads us to repeat behaviors that hurt us in the long run.
They sounded like really nice people in that lab. But I, were you not just terrified? Were you like feeling a bit like a lab rat when you heard about all those things?
You know, it's one of those things where like, you kind of know, like, how do they know all this stuff? But actually going in there, I don't know if I was terrified, because something that I write about in the comfort or in Scarcity Brain is that all these behaviors we overdo, for most people, they're fine. Mm-hmm. Right. So most people can gamble, and they gamble $40 and they, you know, they move on with their life and they're fine. But there's always going to be a subset of the population that overdoes certain behaviors and it really messes them up. For example, me with alcohol, right? So it's one of those things. It's like, how do we balance the fact that we live in a world where we do have access to things that can be really engaging in the short term, but can hurt us in the long run?
But, and you write about this too, the scarcity loop and the scarcity brain, it helped us evolve. I mean, we need it. We needed it, right? Like we continue to need it in terms of, you know, exploring, finding, you know, safe places to live. So I guess the question is like, how do we moderate that?
Yeah. So I'll break down the three parts of the loop. It's got opportunity, unpredictable rewards, quick repeatability. So we'll use the example of a slot machine. You have an opportunity to win money, right? You got an opportunity to get something of value. Two, you know you'll get that thing of value at some point if you keep repeating the behavior. So it's unpredictable, right? With the slot machine, you play a game, the real spin, you could lose your money, you could win a couple bucks, you could win $1 million, literally. And then quick repeatability, you can repeat the behavior immediately. So with slot machines, people play, I think it's 16 games a minute on average. Now, the reason, so this lab that I mentioned, it's not just funded by the gambling industry. There's a lot of big tech companies on board. And so why is that? Well, the reason for that is because you can put this loop into many other things and lead humans to repeat behaviors almost unconsciously and rather quickly. So it's what makes social media work. It's being put into a lot of personal finance apps. It explains the rise of sports gambling. It's in dating apps. It's being put into gig work economy apps. And there's really nothing better, like I said, at getting people to just do a habit over and over and over and over.
If I had, and Penn knows this about me, if I lived in Vegas like you do, I would be the person at the 7-Eleven ordering a pizza to the slot machine there. I know this about myself, that when I have an addictive personality.
You would like that Egyptian hieroglyphic game or whatever the one was, right? Like
right.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, but I know this about myself. Therefore, I have to put a boundary around it. When we haven't been to Vegas in a long time, but I cannot like walk up to a table because I'm not a quitter, Michael. And I'm not going to fold.
She doesn't. She won't fold.
Like, I'm not going to fold.
If you play poker with her, she'll never fold. It's really funny.
And so I'm like, I'm a competitive perfectionist that will lose everything gambling. But in my life, I think how that's manifesting currently is social media.
Yeah.
I think I'm addicted to the information that I could get. And especially now watching what's unfolding in Israel and Gaza. Like I'm addicted to knowing these things and the unpredictability of it. And so reading about that and trying to like put some boundaries on that was really eye-opening to me. Not a question, just telling you my personal problems.
So I have and I'm going to like jump in really quickly too and ask you this, and maybe you can help answer this. Are you addicted to the information or are you addicted to the process and the delivery? Well, just like the delivery system, right?
I think the way, welcome to our podcast, Michael, we'll let you talk in a second.
No, he can answer that as well.
Well, no, I just think explaining how it's being presented, and some of the information's not great. Some of it I'm forwarding to people, right? I'm getting a little buzz off of like, oh, this is great. And the unpredictable rewards and all of that, I think I now can see what's happening. So I'm a little more aware. Am I stepping away? I'm trying to, but okay. Now you can talk. Welcome to our podcast.
I realized that, first of all, you lied to me because I actually didn't answer your question. Your question was, why did we get hooked on it in the first place? So this system evolved to help our ancestors find food and survive. Okay, so if you think of our ancestors finding food, It's the exact same architecture of a slot machine. Okay. So you have an opportunity to get something of value that that enhances your life, literally saves your life back then, because right. You need food or else you're going to starve. So you got to find it though, right? You can't just, it's not predictably there down at the 7-Eleven mm-hmm. in the form of a pizza or whatever. So you go to point A looking for the food. There's nothing there. You go to point B. There's nothing there. You go to point C. Jackpot. You find all this food. It's like ding, ding, ding. Oh my God, we found like this massive berry bush, and that is going to save our life. So that is extremely exciting. And then repeatability, you literally repeat that for the rest of your life because you're always having to find food. But this applies to a lot of other things that would have helped us survive: shelter, status, information, all these different things. And this gets applied in modern life in ways that I would argue aren't always good for us. Mm-hmm. So with your point about information, yeah, that's totally search, right? You're like, you're wondering something. Mm-hmm. So it's this, I'm going to go looking for this piece of it. I'm looking for this. I'm looking for this. And oh my God, I found it. This is the thing I was looking for. Holy crap. So you forward it, and that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. And then you keep searching because you might find the next one. And that will also be exciting. It's just like a slot machine.
We will be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Here's the terrifying part, right? So Kim and I are going through this book. We read about gambling. We're like, yeah, we both like gambling, but we don't really have
we don't have the opportunity.
It's not us. We read about the people foraging for food. Yeah, that's not really us. We're good with that. Then it gets to social media. And dude, we've been in this game for 10 years. We've seen the evolution now. I can see it now. It's like I'm Neo in the Matrix now. You can see the evolution of perfecting the scarcity loop. YouTube starts out, right? They're the first ones, and they figure out this algorithm that keeps people for watching longer. It's all based on what you said. It's like if they're going to rewatch or they're going to click on a new video, that's what does it. Facebook adds the share button. They add like a feed that goes a little quicker. And then TikTok has nearly perfected this exact scarcity loop with shorter videos that seamlessly move into the next one. And their algorithm keeps you in that loop, I think, for longer. And kind of like the way that I can't remember his name, the guy shortened the slot game to give them more opportunities. But just reading your book, I'm like, oh my gosh, they are absolutely using exclusively the scarcity loop to get people to stay on social media longer.
Oh, totally. And the speed is really important. Yeah. So to your point about TikTok being faster, when slot machines, the guy who basically kind of put this system into slot machines in 1980, he realized that if you removed the handles from slot machines, that would increase play, because the act of having to pull a handle, that takes a little bit of time. And so he got rid of that and he put buttons. Now, a button you can just hit. I mean, it's just like scrolling a screen, right? Mm-hmm. And so you start to see the number of games that people play in an hour, it more than doubles.
I think I recognized these habits. It was interesting to be able to zoom out and realize, you know, things that I even thought were for my benefit. You know, I used to be really obsessed with my Apple Watch and checking steps, but I realized it was too intrusive. So I kind of ditched that about a year ago, but then I got an Aura ring and I'm like, oh, this is just to check, you know, my sleep and heart rate variability and things like that. And then I became obsessively Like, I let that determine how my day was going to go. And yeah. I lost it on vacation and I haven't replaced it yet. And I find myself trusting how I feel a little bit more in the morning as opposed to checking an app to see how I feel. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think so. People naturally gravitate to numbers because it gives us certainty. Mm-hmm. So when you wake up in the morning, it's like, how'd you sleep? You're like, well, I think it's pretty good. Right. Like, I don't know. I feel pretty good, but you don't know for sure.
Yeah.
So the reason that a lot of these systems work is because it gives us a clear, did you do well or did you not do well? Right. A slot machine game, you know, if you won and you know exactly how much you won. Same kind of with an Oura Ring. It's like you wake up, you check the number. Oh, my sleep was a 40. That's terrible. Right.
It's terrible. I should
didn't
rest.
Do a good job.
Yeah.
Right. My sleep was an 80. Oh, this is great. And I think one of the underlying problems with, I don't think a lot of those technologies have advanced to the point where you can say with any certainty, really, like, how good was it? We can make some general, you know, but we can make some general conclusions, but it all goes into a sort of black box algorithm that has a lot of underlying issues. And sometimes I think, to your point, that people get fixated on that number. And then it in turn drives their behavior for the rest of the day in a way that maybe isn't good in the long run. So I've written about this a bit. And I think that things like the Oura Ring, things like the Whoop Band, things like the Apple Watch, all the fitness stuff, like you can use it for a while. And I think it can be informative. You know, for example, I had a friend who noticed that his sleep scores were way different on nights that he would have a drink or two before bed, totally messing with his sleep. So I was like, oh, okay, that's like reasonable. The nights that I don't drink, I sleep better. So I can use that information moving forward. But the problem becomes is when you just fixate on that and everything, it determines everything.
All right. So that's interesting. Cause I was going to ask, we're learning about the scarcity loop. I think that just the knowledge of it is going to help us get out of it. Right. Just knowing about it, just hearing, okay, this is what's happening to me. And your brain wants to protest and get out of that loop. Other than the knowledge, what's the best way to get out of the scarcity loop?
Yeah. I think awareness is a good first step. You know, I had a friend put it to me like this, and we were talking about something else. He was like, you know, the dessert tastes really delicious until you find that the chef was using monkey brains in it. And then you don't want to eat the dessert as much, you know?
Yeah.
A second is that you can remove or change any of the three parts of the loop. So you can change or remove the opportunity. So this is why you don't gamble that much.
Yes.
or lost your Oura Ring.
Yeah. Lost my Oura Ring. Yeah.
Yeah. You can change or remove the unpredictable rewards. Mm-hmm. So a good example for phone use is one of the reasons that phones are so stimulating and rewarding is colors, right? The screen hits us with all different colors and colors drive behavior. So I'll give you an example is that if we're driving in a car and we see a sign that is red, we go stop, right? Colors drive our behavior. So if you can put your phone in grayscale, which is a thing you can easily do, it reduces phone use by about 40 minutes on average for people. That's based on a study. So for you, it might be, you know, 30, but it also might be 120. Like mm-hmm. You don't know. Because it takes away the rewards. And then three, you can slow down the repeatability. So an example for shopping is something, especially online, is something that people get really hooked on because it is like, got to search for this item that's going to improve my life. Oh, I found it, buy it. And then you're on there the next day buying more crap you don't need. You can make a rule for yourself that's, you know what, I'm only going to buy things in person. And if this thing is only available online, I'm going to put a holding period on it, right? I'm not just going to buy it immediately. I'm going to go, okay, I'm going to wait 3 days or 7 days or whatever it is. Keep it in the cart. And then you have that pause. You can return and go, yeah, why was I going to buy that? I don't even remember. Okay.
So talking about just that disease of more, there was a quote in here and I had to write it down. You interviewed Stephanie Preston. She's a psychologist from the University of Michigan. And she explained that both overaccumulation and minimalism are, quote, often driven by a kind of perfectionism where you want to do everything just right.
That's
Penn's tapping me. There's a sort of anxiety, but it's different from the overaccumulators. Overaccumulators have anxiety that they're going to make a mistake and need something, so they collect and collect. But minimalists have a kind of anxiety around disorder and having so much they can't escape. He's tapping me because my favorite thing to do is throw things away.
Yeah.
But then
yep.
I will buy stuff and replace it. So I'm sort of both. And my question was, WTF is wrong with me?
That is. I see that written on the page. It says, WTF is wrong with me.
So because I was like, oh my gosh, I am the perfectionist that like I'm overwhelmed by clutter and it's too much and I won't be able to get out of here fast. I have go bags.
You got a quick turnover rate.
Yeah, I have a quick turnover. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as an area is clear, I'll find something. I'm like, oh, this makes me happy and I'll bring it in. So I'm both. Now, Michael Easter, tell me what's wrong with me.
Everything. No, I'm just kidding. Here's what I'll say is that what I'm hearing from you two is that this was maybe informative in your relationship. And the exact same thing happened with me and my wife. Okay. So I'm more, I mean, the camera is centered in such a way that you can't see all the things in my office, like the sort of clutter, the notes, the studies, the whatever. My wife is totally different. Like she needs things in the perfect place, totally organized. And I couldn't get this for the longest time, right? But it turns out that like for me, in order to do my job, I kind of need like stuff around because I'm just sort of frantic thinking ideas or whatever. But for her, she needs everything organized. And I'm like, why are you like this? Well, it turns out that it just like she doesn't feel normal unless things are in a perfect spot. And so I think bringing it back to the sort of the ideas of minimalism and overaccumulating is that we often try and solve maybe some underlying issue by getting everything in its perfect spot. But if it is the cycle where it's like, oh, I'm going to minimize. And then, you know, after 6 months, you've bought a bunch of stuff. And then it's like, oh, I got to minimize now. It becomes a cycle where you're just kind of endlessly spending money and caught in a loop. And so this, I think this lady's message, Stephanie Preston, was you got to find out, like, why do you need that in the first place? And is there another way that you can solve that that won't lead you to continue buying and purging over time?
I'm so glad you brought up your wife. Okay. So you have in these books, part of your personal discovery is just doing crazy stuff. Like you went into this area of Alaska that was like incredibly cold and barren and there's bears and you don't have any food for a month, right? That was your Misogi, which we can talk about later. And then in Scarcity Brain, you hung out for a week in Baghdad with a special forces, like drug bust, weapons
whatever
bust
that was.
Unit. Yeah. So like how, I'm trying to think about how I would bring that up to my wife. Like, here's what I'm going to do. And I feel like it would start with something like, hey, and then I don't know what I would do after that. Like, I want to know, could you please take me through the conversation? And she's welcome to come in and join on this answer if you'd like to invite her.
Here's what I'll say about her is that she kind of realizes this is part of the job I have to do, that it's kind of part of the deal. I think she also trusts me to do a lot of homework. So for example, before I go to Baghdad, I went and met with
the guy in Mexico. Yeah.
Mike Moreno. And he was in the CIA in Baghdad for I think 8 or 9 years during like the hot point of the war. And so he kind of taught me everything I needed to know. Of course, things happen. Right. But, you know, I'm doing my homework. It's part of the job. So she's, I don't know. She doesn't say much to me. Maybe internally she's like, the hell are you doing?
We should bring her in.
Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
So she's way more chill than I am is what I've learned.
Well, the other thing is that I think is important is that we don't have kids. So if I had kids, would I be going to Baghdad? Would I be spending 30 whatever days in the Arctic? I don't know. Probably not. I mean, maybe not 30 days in the Arctic. It would be like, okay, we got to do like a week or two, right? Mm-hmm. Or
Dick Light.
Yeah. Or maybe it's not Baghdad. Maybe it's somewhere else. I don't know.
Okay. That's a good answer. Back to the book. Okay. We can get into your personal life in a second, but do you see, I mean, the overaccumulation, that's just like the desire for more. I mean, I fall into it too. I mean, I finished reading a few chapters last night and then was online shopping for, it got slightly cool here. And then I was buying a new coat and I was like, whoa, okay, whoa. I have way more, I have an embarrassing amount of warm weather gear for where we live. So I became aware of it. Is this a uniquely American problem? Just like this overconsumption of stuff and things, or is this everyone?
No, I think it's everywhere. For sure. I mean, some cultures are, I think, even more buy more stuff than even we do.
Really?
I think that probably what has constrained it over time is just simply resources. And you're starting to see that things are becoming cheaper across the board. And as the world develops, they have more disposable income. So I think you're just going to see consumption sort of rise over time.
I sort of daydream. We have neighbors who moved to Costa Rica with their three kids for a year, and they came back. The parents wanted to stay. The kids, obviously, they're young kids. They wanted to come back. And they, first of all, came back so relaxed. And they said it was pretty overwhelming to come. Their first trip to Trader Joe's was so overwhelming. They had to walk out because there were so many options. And when they were in Costa Rica, you just go to this market and it's like, it is what it is. Like what is there is there. So they talked about, they're just so much more aware of all of the stuff that we're faced with. Mm-hmm. You know, options are good, right? But to a point, it can be anxiety producing, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is why I love Costco, because they only give you like two choices for the things you want, right?
Yeah.
it's like you can have this rice or that rice, and it's all just in bulk. It cuts down on the decision-making fatigue. I do think, though, that you see, and maybe this gets to your question better, that when people have other things going on in their life, they're less likely to shop and kind of fill it with shopping. So I'll give you an example is that I talked to this psychologist whose name's Thomas Zental, and he's been doing work with pigeons where he can basically get a pigeon to turn into a degenerate gambler, like very fast.
This is crazy.
And these pigeons, they kind of live in these small like cages that are a little bit cooped up, and he'll then occasionally put them in this big cage where they have to do like all these things that pigeons would normally have to do to survive in the wild. So they got to like build their nest. They're socializing with other pigeons. They're like working hard. They're doing all these things that pigeons evolved to do. And then when he puts them back in the situation where they can choose a gambling game or a game that gets them a predictable amount of food, they tend to choose the optimal game where they get a predictable amount of food. And so his point then was, you know, and I don't think we're that different when you live in a really developed country. We're not that different than the pigeons, whereas we live lives that are way different than we evolved to live, right? In the past, it's like we would have been searching for food all day. We would have been having to struggle a little bit more. We would have spent a lot more time outside. Like there's just all these different things we would have done. And that seems to provide us a lot of stimulation. And so when we don't get that level of stimulation, I think we go looking for it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Buy stuff, you gamble, we maybe drink more, we maybe, you know, go down crazy information rabbit holes. And it's just sort of a mismatch between how humans evolved over 2.5 million years to live and the environments we live in now.
So it seems like for you, the thing that hits you the most personally was the stuff.
Me?
Yeah. Either that or the social media.
I think, well, also you wrote about how there was a study of this. I had to like back up and read that. I'm going to get this wrong, but there was a study about people who were participants in the Boston Marathon at the time of the bombing, and then people who just binge watch information about it. And that hit me this week because I've been having a tough time sleeping, just watching all the images come out of Gaza. And the people that just binge watch the information about it had more PTSD. I'm getting this wrong. They suffered
higher
more.
Rates of PTSD. You got it right.
Yeah.
They had higher rates of PTSD compared to the people who were actually in the bombing, which is wild. I think that, so here's the deal, is that the world as a whole has been getting better over time. I mean, you look at, I mean, even just since 1990, we have more, there's just so many things have improved, right? But the news is always going to run the same amount of negative information, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that captivates our information, or captivates our attention, rather. That's kind of what we want to consume. But I don't think that that's always an accurate reflection of how the world is doing as a whole, historically. And I do think that it affects us. It really just throws us into that loop. So the answer for me is, you know, it's this tension between, I want to be aware of things that are happening in the world. At the same time, we also have to keep in the back of our mind that things as a whole have greatly improved over time. And two, that the new system can lead us to not necessarily realize that. So it's kind of this strange tension we have to deal with.
And you want to pay attention because I want to be able to, you know, be an ally. I want to be able to have the information to enter those conversations for people who can't. I want to, and I don't want to kind of turn away from that. But then if I don't protect myself, I'll burn out and have, like, I haven't slept in a week. I mean, that's not helping anybody. So I just need to find a balance, like you said, of realizing that they are, the news right now is sort of gamifying my attention when it comes down to it.
Yeah, totally. And I think that there's probably some sources out there that can maybe help you not fall into the loop of the searching, whether it's certain newsletters that just kind of round things up. I mean, that's going to give you the information so you're conscious of it and can make decisions about, okay, what am I going to do about this? Mm-hmm. But not thrust you in the loop of watching crazy videos online, getting every gory detail, getting, you know, yeah. So there was an interesting piece in the New York Times. I think it was maybe like 5 years ago. So it's slightly dated, but one of their reporters who was, you know, this sort of Twitter addict, more or less, he decided that he was only going to get his information from print media for a while, for a month. And at the end of that, he didn't feel like he was any less informed, but he felt like he was way more present in his day-to-day life. Mm. He felt like he also had better information because there's more vetting behind the print product. And he just felt like psychologically better. Like his life wasn't moving as fast and he wasn't as frantic and there wasn't many spikes in his, you know, day-to-day situation.
If we can find some print media, that sounds like a great idea. I don't know where to find it anymore, but it's
the problem is I subscribe to New York Times online.
Yeah.
So then
look at that.
Here's where I get my, it's an expensive subscription, but I do The Economist. You get it every week.
Okay.
Runs down the entire world. And so when I eat breakfast, I will read that. Because the other thing is that you get a lot of stuff in here, other things happening around the world that I think are important, but it's not, I mean, they have my attention. There's no incentive to run the crazy gory video, the crazy gory headline, because when you look at how information is presented online, it's in competition with other information presented online.
Yeah.
You're having to frame it in a way that captures attention. With a print product, they already have your attention.
Yeah.
So there's no captive need audience. To run the headline that's like, you know, X-year-old child dies in whatever, blah, blah, blah. Like just the crazy stuff that's going to grab us.
Yeah.
Okay. So it seems to me like that stuff that stopped you in your tracks. I feel like sometimes you're reading a book and you heard about the Boston bombing and basically just kind of shush everything out. And like, this is like, I want to stop and think about this.
Right.
That happened to me pretty early on in your book, as in, like, I'm an ADHD person. I'm an advocate for ADHD. We just finished a book on ADHD. And you started talking about dopamine as first of all, a misunderstood chemical in your brain, but also something that affects decision making, regulates, you know, a lot of the parts of your body. But scientifically, people who have ADHD, we've known this for a while, appear to have a deficiency of dopamine. We don't have enough of it, so we hunt for it more. And for that reason, we're more prone to addiction, right? We're more prone to a lot of bad things, divorce, suicide, all of those things. What advice would you have to the ADHD community in dealing with scarcity brain?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, that's one that's probably better for a clinician, someone who's really researched the topic and works in it. But I will say that kind of the underlying themes of a lot of my book is that we live in a world now where we have just so many things hitting us with opportunity to feel something, right? And it's often uncomfortable to have to sit with yourself and go through hard things. But that often is the answer that brings you better long-term results. I have a couple members of my family who also have ADHD. And for them, it has been, you know, they have suffered from addiction. They've had other problems. I think they've, you know, had to realize that this is this thing I have. It's not always going to be easy, but if I'm trying to, you know, take the sort of the comfortable, very easy way out of it, escape it, that has led to long-term problems for them.
That's a pretty good answer. Like, I don't think good I need answer. To ask a clinician. That no, sit in the suck. That's what you're saying. And that, like, that's advice that's been given to me before as well. So, well done, sir.
Okay. So, the comfort crisis, amazing. Scarcity brain, amazing. You've written these things. Do you still day-to-day live by the things you've learned?
Like, I try.
You
I
try.
Do feel like that. Yeah.
Your life is remarkable. It's like profoundly changed from all this research.
Oh, it's definitely profoundly changed, but I will say that it fluctuates based on how close to the experiences I am. So, you know, for example, when I got back from a month in the Arctic, it's like the first time running water hit my hands. It was like, oh my God, you just realize how amazing modern life is, mm-hmm. right? You have a really deep appreciation for all of this stuff that you literally never thought of. You mm-hmm. just kind of took it for granted. And it's just like, holy hell. You're walking around wide-eyed about the dumbest stuff, like the fact that there's a pantry full of food, the fact that hot running water just appears out of the faucet. Obviously, that slows down over time, right? It's not like 3 years later, every time I wash my hands with hot water, I'm breaking out in a crazy grin. And so I think for me, the answer is to, I mean, I still have that in the back of my mind. Like, yeah, this is amazing. Like, things are pretty good right now in the grand scheme of time and space. But I do think that experience is the best teacher for humans. And I think we often have to do things that are, you know, out of our comfort zone to realize, I guess, how good we have it and the things that are good in our life. Now, I am not saying that the world is perfect by any means, but I am saying that, like, if you had to choose a time to be alive, now's not bad. When you would choose,
like, right? At least for the next 100 years before we burn the planet down. But like, yeah. I can't wait to see what you do next to discover stuff. I have a guess of what you're doing next. Ooh. I'm sure it's wrong, but like, so you've done.
Let's hear it.
I think you're going to space next. I feel like that would be the next. You should go to space next, because there's a lot of, you're gonna, I heard you talking to the guy from the space station. I've actually done this before as well with a guy, and
that's awesome.
And here, yeah. So it was the same thing. He called me up and we chatted. He'd read a book, but like when you saw the Lake Erie and how clear it was, like through a camera, I think like you would be able to write a really good book if you went to space. Oh, God. And it sounds really cheap and reasonable.
Very inexpensive, right?
Are you going to space next? Come on. Maybe you can't tell me, but I bet you're going to space next.
I'd never thought of that.
Yes!
Now that you've planted the
Go
seed,
to space!
I have a deep... So things I would never do is... I'll tell you. So you're getting like obsessed with the news around the situation in Gaza. I got so obsessed with that Titanic submersible sub.
Oh, yeah.
Holy hell.
Yeah.
Like right when it... I'm like, these people are in a...
And a tin can.
Like, I would never want you to go
Don't go up.
Go up.
Yeah. I just met you, but we adore you. Please do not go down. Are you going to go down to the depths?
No, I'm
ocean?
Not. I'm not. Like, water is something that I need to explore. Why I'm just like, I don't really need to get in the sub. I don't really need to go surfing. I don't really need to. There's something.
Well, you're a land mammal.
That's like my. I live in the Mojave Desert for a reason.
No, I'm a water person. I love to like surf, be in the water, paddleboard, the whole thing. But I don't need to like be like really far under it without a way to like breathe independently.
They like got crushed into a tiny
little
ball.
I don't even want to talk
right?
about
Didn't
it.
Didn't they?
I
yeah.
I don't want to talk
okay,
about
sorry.
it. No, it's bad.
Yeah, I think being in a small space that is literally inescapable is one that I'm just like.
Oh okay. So God, maybe not space.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Well, we'll see.
Well, this is my issue with like the accumulation of stuff. I have to think there's this TikTok. There was like, it turns out a lot of men obsessively think about the Roman Empire. You know, a lot of wives were asking their partners,
really?
Like, how often do you think of the Roman Empire? And a lot of men admitted to thinking about it. Like at least weekly.
This is the dumbest.
And it was so.
I'm sorry.
And the new trend is like, what's your Roman Empire? Like women talked about like their Roman Empire. Mine, I think, really obsessively about having, and I don't know why. I have had a very privileged life about having to like run with my family. Like we need to go. And it is so weird that I need to like that. This is why that is what I think about fast. So I think being in space or underwater, I couldn't go quickly. So that's my.
She bought four go bags. They're in our.
Yeah. If I need to go, I have as food. It's not good food, but I have like water.
So why don't we, like,
backpacking food?
Yeah,
we should just go camping with our go bag.
Yeah. But anyway,
this conversation is coming to a natural end.
No. Well, I will say that the comfort, we'll wrap up with the comfort crisis. I loved the Misogi and how that challenge we did. I think we've edited it in that my version of it is like, let's do something like really hard and uncomfortable physically. This year we try to learn kite surfing. We experienced some, you know,
with some success and some failure. It I know that you said it needed to have a 50-50 chance of success, and I still don't know if we succeeded or not with that one. So the problem with that Misogi is we didn't put a real parameter on what success looked like. I mean, we got up.
Yeah.
But we can't do it by ourselves.
Yeah.
For a long time. It's really hard.
No, but I think my issue with the Misogi is that you're not really supposed to talk about it. So I need ideas. I think I'm a creative person, but I still need ideas on what to do.
I want to do the rock thing that Kyle Korver or whoever did, like the underwater rock one.
Anyway.
I have a solution for you. So I got this question a lot. It's like, well, what should I do?
Right.
And my answer was always, well, part of the point is that you got to be introspective.
Yeah.
And I realized I could only say that so much. And so I need to like actually help people find ideas. And so I have this newsletter called 2%. And so I basically just sent out an email to everyone who's on the list and was like, hey, if you've done a Misogi, send in your name, your age, and what you did. And so I have this big running list of all these things that people have done, with the idea being like, we send it out and it's like, here's all these things that people have done. Maybe this will give you an idea. So I can send you guys that.
Okay. What is the funniest one?
I subscribe to your newsletter, by the way. Okay.
I want to subscribe now. What's the funniest one you've gotten where you were like, holy, holy crap, and you laughed a little bit? It could be ridiculous or funny.
Oh, that's a good question. The funniest one? I don't know. I will tell you the coolest one I've gotten was from, I just got this random email one day, and it's like a person, Janet, I can't remember her last name, and the subject is Misogi, and the entire email just said, hello, Michael, my name is Janet. I am 79 years old. I am going to do a Misogi. It will be hard. I won't die. Thank you, Janet.
Oh, Janet.
I was like, hell yeah, Janet. Janet is very, very cool.
I want to be friends with Janet. Did we ever hear back from Janet to confirm she did not die?
No, we did not. Oh, but no. I think I probably would have heard something if things gone wrong.
Yeah, she was like carrying a rock underneath the ocean. Okay.
Yeah, and I think the point is it really is you got to meet yourself where you're at. You know, my mom did one, and it was, you know, hiking 6 miles instead of the 3 she does every day. But I think the important part is that showed her that she was more physically capable than she thought. And because of that, she ended up booking a trip that she had wanted to take, but didn't think that she could do because it had a lot of walking. So that's kind of what we're after there.
Go mom. Okay. Yeah. We're going to be linking to your books and our show notes and our blog and all that stuff. But where else can people find you and find information about what you're doing?
EasterMichael.com is my website, and the newsletter goes out a few times a week, and it's at TWOPCT.com. So it's called 2%.
2%.
It was really cool getting to know you, man, like especially after reading the books. And thank you for helping us go outside our comfort zone.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.